Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim McCormick joining me, a professor of political science at Iowa State University, but this semester, he is visiting Carleton University in Canada on a Fulbright Fellowship, from where he joins us. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So good to have you with us. A little later in the hour, we'll be joined by a new member of our Politics Wednesday crew. Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa will be with us a little bit later in the program. Let's jump right into it. Jim, as you probably heard there in the top of the hour news, we have a number of things to talk about that have very recent developments. Let's talk about today the testimony of Attorney General Jeff Sessions before the Senate Judiciary Committee on oversight of the U.S. Department of Justice, facing today a wide range of questions, including questions on the Russia investigation, also former FBI Director James Comey. Before you comment, Jim, let's listen to this from just moments ago, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as I said, in front of that Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. At one point, Senator Patrick Leahy asking Sessions about the special counsel's investigation.
Have you been interviewed, or have you been requested to be interviewed by the special counsel, either in connection with Director Comey's firing, the Russian investigation, or your own contact with Russian officials?
You'll have to ask the special counsel.
No, I'm asking you.
Repeat the question then.
Have you been interviewed or been requested to be interviewed by the special counsel, either in connection with Director Comey's firing, the Russian investigation, or your own contact with Russian officials?
Well, I'd be pleased to answer that. I'm not sure I should without clearing that with a special counsel. What do you think?
I'm just saying, have you been interviewed? By them?
No.
You haven't been interviewed by the special counsel in any way, shape, or manner?
The answer is no.
Okay. What a curious exchange. Jim McCormick, react to that, and what do you see going on right now?
Well, yeah, it is a very strange reaction here that he couldn't answer the question, and he sort of threw the Sessions threw the question back to the senator, saying that whether he should answer or not. I don't know if there was some informal discussion between Sessions and the special counsel or what. Because he seemed to be very hesitant to say forthrightly whether he had been interviewed or not. I'm not sure how that is a sort of a protected question.
Yeah, I don't know. Also, the headline here so far out of this testimony this morning from the Attorney General telling lawmakers he's not going to discuss his conversations with Trump about the Comey firing there as well. Also, to add to this, Monday of this week, Jim, investigators working with the FBI special counsel Robert Mueller interviewed the former White House press secretary Sean Spicer. Spicer resigned in July, but it's known that he took copious notes in his role as press secretary. Investigators reportedly want to know if Spicer was aware of Trump's decision to fire the FBI director James Comey. So many facets of the Russia investigation, but really a key one, if not the key one, is the firing of James Comey, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of the centerpiece of this whole discussion in some ways. To what extent, you know, did the president try to, first of all, call for Comey to support him, and secondly, to go easy, if you will, on Michael Flynn in terms of any kind of indictment or investigation of him, and then, of course, the actual firing itself, which was a curious action.
Mm-hmm. CNN reporting this morning a growing number of key Republicans that they've spoke to are sending the messages to the congressional committees investigating potential Trump collusion with the Russians to wrap it up, sort of grumbling about this. It's been going on the better part of the past 9 months, and they say that the push to extend the investigation could amount to a fishing expedition. Of course, Donald Trump is right on board even further with this. He's insisted he's the subject of a witch hunt. Democrats raising their concerns about rushing witnesses before the special counsel, including testimony by the president's son. What are your thoughts on how long this will last? No one knows, do they?
I mean, I think it's going to be some time yet, because what you really have to do is there are a couple committees still investigating, and they haven't issued any kind of report. And I think the question is whether the reports from those investigating committees will come out before the special counsel issues, you know, his report or undertake some indictments, as seem to be coming forth, at least the way I would view things here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are going to be some people that are clearly going to be indicted. I mean, there's also the report that Flynn's son is now being questioned by the special counsel's office, and you know what information he might have about his father's dealings with regard to the Russians, and then the, you know, just kind of curious session with the Attorney General when he was interviewed by Senator Franken here, and his reluctance to recall what he was told. He couldn't recall what he talked about when meeting with the Russian ambassador and so on. So I think there's so many strings that are not connected yet, at least in the public view. Maybe the special counsel has had success in doing that. That I think that this is going to go on, and frankly, it's probably going to run right up until the 2018 elections, mm-hmm. It seems, congressional elections.
We don't know when we'll get the reports from the special counsel and from the Senate and the,
right.
and the House. But, I mean, I don't know who said it was a nothing burger. We definitely know at this point it is not a nothing burger.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that wasn't that Senator Graham that said it was a nothing burger, as I recall, but that with regard to Russia here and the mm-hmm. Trump administration. But in any event, we don't know what the outcome is. And I think that continues to hang over the administration's head. And I noticed that the president just a few days ago, called for the ending of the Russian investigation. But I think he's unlikely to get his wish here.
Right. He said, quote, they ought to get rid of, to end it, because I think the American public is sick of it. Now, I guess that depends on your point of view as a person in the American public. Let's talk about the federal judge in Maryland blocking parts of President Trump's most recent attempt to impose broad limits on who can enter the U.S., a so-called travel ban. A day before Trump's ban was set to effect that this happens. We also had a federal judge in Hawaii in a related
right.
case here. So the Trump travel ban 3.0 put on hold again.
Absolutely. And what is interesting, again, with these decisions is that they cited the campaign statements that candidate Trump made with regard to attacks upon on Muslims, and then making it even broader here, at least the one in Maryland, that this kind of using nationality at all was a violation of our constitutional principles here. So it really will be interesting to see how the Supreme Court comes down, both in terms of whether nationality and religion, which has been the basis of the decisions in some of the earlier putting those bans on hold, whether that will be also followed through by the Supreme Court or not.
Jim, we are talking to you today as you are at your temporary home in Canada there, at Carleton University on a Fulbright Fellowship. It's a good chance to ask you about your thoughts on how our closest friends, of course, Canada included, in that the Europeans as well, how they're viewing these developments with the travel ban and the travel ban in itself.
Well, you know, they have their own issues here, obviously, in Canada. Quebec just is on the verge of passing legislation, a provincial legislation that would outlaw burqas or any covering of the head in Quebec. And, of course, that is in some ways parallels the kind of issues that you're seeing with regard to the travel ban. I mean, because it is seen as discriminatory, and it's a source of great controversy, and probably has eclipsed, even the kind of coverage that normally you get about all of the American activities. I've kind of been monitoring the news here, and they often open with two or three stories about the U.S. rather than Canada, and so you know that that's a real target here. The travel ban, I think, at least a discussion, it certainly was mentioned, but really this Quebec kind of issue, which in some ways, in my view, mimics some of the things going on with the travel ban, is more the source of attention right at the moment here in Canada.
Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, currently on leave as a Fulbright fellow in Canada, joining us this first half hour. And in second half hour as well, we'll add a guest then as well. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Let's talk about the latest installment of what's been happening with the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. This morning, the president again criticizing this bipartisan Senate deal this week to curb the growth of insurance premiums. Here's a tweet, Jim, from the president this morning. I am supportive of Lamar. Now, this is Lamar Alexander, the Republican in Tennessee. He says, I am tweeting, I am supportive of Lamar as a person and also of the process, but I can never support bailing out CEOs who have made a fortune with Obamacare. Let's listen to Chuck Schumer. Comments this morning on the Senate floor. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer saying that President Trump did not understand the Alexander Murray compromise and standing in the way of good work.
First, the president ought to know what the bill is about before he tweets. Clearly, from this tweet, he doesn't. Second, this president keeps zigging and zagging, so it's impossible to govern. Two Thursdays ago, the president called me in the gym and said, let's work on a bipartisan solution on health care. It was his initiation. He first talked about let's repeal and replace. I told him that's off the table. But I then said that Senator Alexander and Senator Murray are working on a compromise, and I outlined the basic compromise they were coming up with, that each side got something.
Okay, that's Chuck Schumer this morning. Jim, yeah, address this comment. He called it zig and zag here.
Oh, I would agree with Senator Schumer there. I mean, just yesterday he came out and seemingly supported this legislation, and then apparently his White House advisors got to him, and I suspect also some members of his party, and particularly in the House, who have really registered objections to any kind of monetary bailout, and then he changes direction. And I think Schumer is right. I mean, how do you possibly govern when there's, when you get differing signals from the president? I mean, I think although it's hard for this president, he ought to hold his fire a little bit until he's found out exactly what the bill said and what his actual position is on the bill. Because there was a component to give more flexibility to the states under this. Yes, there was a funding in the proposed bill, or is funding in the proposed bill, to try to have cost control on some of the premiums. But I just think that you really have got to step back, particularly as an executive, and understand what your position is and what the legislation that you're commenting really contains. And this is a clear case of that not being done.
What are you seeing in terms of reaction from congressional leaders? I guess the GOP support?
Well, the House has been relatively silent on this. I was surprised that the Speaker, at least at this juncture, and maybe there's been a more recent statement, hasn't come out and has commented on this. Certainly there have been some members of the, sort of the Freedom Caucus and so on within the House that have come out and condemned this. The problem is that Republicans have that are not part of the Freedom Caucus is that they've got to run in districts where they, you know, have been elected, but also have a number of people that have signed up for Obamacare, and you know they'll have to pay the price for the rise in premiums here. Mm-hmm. If there's not something done. So I think some of them have been, in that sense, silent on this and see if something can be hammered out.
Mm-hmm. Democrats, are they unified in opposition to this? I mean, obviously, this is a bipartisan deal. Patty Murray of Washington State in on it, too. But I suppose they're open. I mean, they were quite unified in their opposition to any repeal, right?
Yeah, they're unified in opposition to repeal, but I think this is, as some of the critics say, I mean, this is going to at least a 2-year period, is the way the legislation is proposed, largely keep Obamacare in place with governmental subsidies. The big unknown is the kind of flexibility that's written into the legislation to give states a greater chance to maybe offer alternatives that may well be cheaper, and in that sense, the states have greater sway over where things are headed, and maybe not have as many people, you know, transfer to Medicare and so on. So. The Democrats, though, at least what I've observed, have been relatively silent. And Schumer was quick to come out yesterday, you may remember, after the agreement was announced, in sort of very strongly endorsing this. I think he may have gotten to the microphones even before President Trump did.
Right. Well, let's focus in on the president's relationship with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Let's play a couple clips here because they had a get-together this week in the, I think it was the Rose Garden, wasn't it?
Yep.
But let's hear from McConnell and Trump. After meeting at the White House, President Trump praised the relationship between himself and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. In the Rose Garden, Trump said that McConnell is a friend and has been a friend for a long time.
Long before my world of politics, early into his world of politics, I think. But we've been friends for a long time. We are probably now, despite what we read, we're probably now, I think, at least as far as I'm concerned, closer than ever before.
Okay, this morning the president tweeted out another push for changes to the tax code. Senate Majority Leader McConnell simplified the plan as getting money from D.C. to everyday Americans.
We want to take more money out of Washington's pockets and put more money in the pockets of hardworking men and women throughout our country. These are goals shared by the president, by his team, and by Senate colleagues. They're certainly shared by our Republican colleagues. I would think they'd be shared by all of us on both sides of the aisle, and our Democratic friends did share them until just recently. I hope they'll continue to support these common sense goals rather than just blindly oppose this effort to fight corporate offshoring and to eliminate loopholes for the wealthy, simply because they don't like the current occupant of the White House.
Okay, so McConnell and Trump in the Rose Garden having a meeting to say that their friendship is as good as any. I suppose if you do that, you're trying to counter the appearance that it's not good, and we have plenty of evidence to see that it isn't, right, Jim?
Yes, you have to swallow hard to accept that that statement. It seems to me because you know there have been a lot of tweets coming at least in one direction towards Senator McConnell in terms of particularly his failure to get Congress or at least sort of the Senate to pass a repeal of Obamacare here. So I have to take that with a grain of salt, I think, is the best best I can come up with.
Mentioned tax reform there during the cabinet meeting on Monday, the president vowing to sign, in his words, the largest tax cut in the history of our country. I don't know how much you've kept your eye on how this tax reform bill is shaping up and the support that it has. What are your thoughts there, Jim?
Well, I think that the key thing is, and I think what they're trying to move the legislation through is this budget resolution here, which incorporates a provision that allows, I was looking at it just this morning, it allows for the Finance Committee to spend $1.5 trillion here in terms of basically for the tax cuts. And the key thing is it can be done under reconciliation, where they would only need 50 votes in the Senate. Now, it's unclear to me how the House would react to this. If there's, I think they would be supportive, certainly, of these kind of tax cuts. But the question is whether there would be some opposition, even among Republicans, because it's not clear that this would not enlarge the debt considerably. And we've already seen Senator Paul say that he might actually vote against the budget resolution because it has some increases in defense spending. And then if you get to the larger package or the larger bill here, is the other bill that deals with the tax cut, I mean, what would be his position? And would there be, you know, one or two other Republicans that might, you know, demur on any kind of increase in the in the debt?
So
I think it's uncertain. I mean, I guess the bottom line is that the tax cuts, I wouldn't spend the tax cuts yet.
Mm-hmm. So, but what you're describing, this rather complicated process, the budget process could sort of help unlock a fast track procedure.
That's right.
for the Republicans and exclude the Democrats. And using a simple majority without any Democratic votes to entirely rewrite our tax code.
Absolutely. Yeah, that could be. But there would be incentives, it seems to me, for some Democrats maybe to jump on board. Because, you know, tax cuts are pretty popular with the American public. And simplifying as a promise, you know, to move to a more simplified tax system here. You know, under the proposed legislation, there would be three categories, although, you know, that we had three categories back in the 1980s with President Reagan. And, of course, those categories got morphed over time into more of tax and tax levels here. Mm-hmm. And so there might be some, you know, concern that might happen again. But they might be able to pick up some Democratic support. But you're right. It's possible that the tax code could be rewritten by Republicans.
Right. And I'm just wondering, I'm thinking back in conversations on this program years ago, you've been part of them too, Jim, where all the Republicans could talk about was, oh, we've got to stop the ballooning of the deficit.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're still at $20 trillion and, you know, moving forward in terms of the national debt here. And, you know, there's not been any kind of, you know, real pullback on that, even though that is a perennial for various candidates for president, you know, that we ought to do something about the debt.
Okay.
It's very hard to do that.
Jim McCormick, stay with us, joining us today from Canada. He's professor of political science at Iowa State University. Coming on board stateside, Evan Renfro will be with us of the University of Northern Iowa, where he's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science, also a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst. We'll talk with him, get his political views on the latest on our landscape when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, I'll be talking with the award-winning cartoonist Tom Tomorrow. He is actually a person who grew up in Iowa. Talk with him tomorrow, creator of the political cartoon This Modern World. Also tomorrow, a conversation with the 2017 World Food Prize laureate from Nigeria. Coming up tomorrow. And another reminder, don't forget this. You can join us tonight at the IPR's Great Iowa Potluck, tonight at 5:30 at the Park Lodge at the Terry Trueblood Recreation Area in Iowa City, just south of Iowa City. You can bring a dish to share. Doesn't matter if it's sweet, savory, or a salad or dessert. We'll provide the plates, tableware, lemonade, and you're welcome to bring your own adult beverages. As they say, I'll be there along with Charity Debbie. Dennis Reese will be there. A lot of our IPR staff will be attending. Door prizes, and you can find out more at our Facebook page or at iowapublicradio.org. Also, a performance out on the patio outdoors because it'll be a beautiful evening by Iowa singer-songwriter Elizabeth Moen. Hope you'll join us tonight. Back with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Evan Renfro is with us for the first time on this Politics Wednesday edition. We have, as regular listeners know, a couple dozen analysts with diverse areas of expertise. Evan Renfro comes to us from the University of Northern Iowa, where he is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science. Evan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Good to be with you.
Also want to mention, interesting background here, you're a former United States Air Force intelligence analyst and senior civilian intelligence analyst. Before we analyze a little bit of what's going on, in a minute or less, tell us, what did that entail, your earlier intelligence work?
Oh, goodness, that had some global travel to it. I got to vacation in beautiful areas like Hawaii, but I also got to go to less happy locales and study our adversaries and our friends and try to understand the geopolitical regime in which the U.S. tries to work.
Mm-hmm. And you have specific areas of the globe that you would say those are your focuses?
Well, the Middle East was my primary focus. My master's degree is in that, in Arabic. Mm-hmm. So regionally, I'm a Middle East guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's start there with you and Jim commenting on, let's go to Iraq, Iraqi troops and allied militia retaking this week the northern province of Kirkuk. It has, of course, these lucrative oil fields. They also, these Iraqi troops, took a couple of formerly Kurdish-held areas that were outside of the Kurdish autonomous region. Evan, start us off. Help us understand the significance of this, what was a lightning-quick operation, right, that saw the troops sweep into this disputed Kurdish-held territory.
That's right. And the territory that the Kurds were holding, they had actually taken after the Iraqi military fled back in 2014 from the approaching ISIS forces, which have since been cleaned out. Now, Kirkuk actually is, as you say, very lucrative in the oil business to the tune of 800,000 barrels a day and $8 billion a year. So definitely the Baghdad, the Iraqi government, wanted this territory back, and sure enough, they got it with very little resistance.
Mm-hmm. And now we are allied with both sides here, the Kurds and the Iraqi government troops. So how does that work itself out when you're backing forces fighting each other?
So, you know, the U.S. was strongly opposed to this Kurdish referendum that they overwhelmingly voted for sort of this autonomous or independence from Iraq. So the U.S.
This happened last month.
This happened just a month ago, and the U.S.'s big problem with that is we are afraid that you're going to see an increase in ethnic violence, you're going to have a destabilization in Iraq, you're going to also undermine the U.S. and allied effort against ISIS. So all in all, the calculation of the Kurdish folks led by Barzani was a gross miscalculation. I think their intent was to encourage the government in Baghdad to negotiate with them for autonomy and independence, but Iraq did not do that.
They just took it back.
They just took it back.
Mm-hmm. Jim, jump in here. What does this mean for that area in Iraq going forward? What do you see there? What are your questions in your mind?
Well, the issue of the Kurds, you know, just is a continuous one. It's been really decades or maybe even centuries that the Kurds have wanted to establish an independent state. And the U.S. position, of course, particularly because, you know, Turkey's our ally as well as now working with the Iraqi government, we have to certainly not support the creation of an independent Kurdistan here. I think the best that the U.S. would probably support is some kind of an autonomous region. I mean, that really goes back to the whole discussion about with regard to the future of Iraq. But the Kurds opposition with the Turks and with the Iraqis, as well as the Iranians too, because it's really carved out of those three societies where a Kurdistan would come about. So it's really part of this kind of nationalist surge that we've seen in other parts of the world as well over the last little time.
Mm-hmm. And I would just quickly add here that the Kurds have been crucial allies also in countering ISIS. The Peshmerga forces have been very effective.
When the U.S.-backed Iraqi forces have not been effective in the past.
That's right. And, for instance, the Syrian Democratic Forces that just took Raqqa in Syria away from Daesh or ISIS is, you know, 40% of that group is Kurdish. So, great ally.
Let's talk about Raqqa. That development also this week. We're still with ISIS, but now we're in Syria. U.S.-backed Syrian forces driving the Islamic State group from what is their de facto capital, right? Raqqa.
That's it.
Operations I'm seeing in reports are underway currently to uncover some jihadist sleeper cells, remove landmines and so forth from the last areas of Raqqa. The UN says it's ready to get to Raqqa after 3 years of occupation by ISIS. So, Evan, give us a picture of what has happened to the Islamic State over the past few months and what this point, this liberation of Raqqa, represents.
Yeah, so the ISIS has had a very tough few months. They've lost about 90% of the territory they held, including Iraq and Syria. They're down to a few pathetic desert outposts sort of on the Syrian-Iraqi border. Raqqa was their headquarters, their crown jewel, and to lose it the way they lost it, I think, is about the final nail in the coffin as far as an existential threat or a very serious threat. ISIS is on its last legs.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you think this means ISIS is on the brink of being completely eliminated, or will we see one of these morphings into, a guerrilla force?
It seems to me it has metastasized into northern Africa here, or maybe even to central Africa, and, of course, in Yemen here. And there are still going to be remnants. It'll be interesting to see because the other dynamic in Syria, of course, is the Syrian government, and you know the Russians are there, and how this plays out as well, and whether ISIS or that remnant of ISIS that Evan mentioned here will turn just to kind of guerrilla activities or not, I think, is the other kind of question.
Mm-hmm. What does this mean, Evan, let me toss this your way. What does this mean for U.S. interest in the area, the fact that that Raqqa has fallen, that the Islamic State after 3 years has been driven out?
Well, it's a big win for sure. And don't get me wrong, as ISIS is degraded here, it's not going to be peace and love and rainbows and no more terrorism ever. They'll definitely grow into some other terror network. Mm-hmm. However, ISIS sort of, they were very good at recruiting jihadists from around the world, and their ability to recruit and attract new fighters has significantly dissipated due to these losses. It's just not the cool network to join anymore. Now, mm-hmm. the big question is what will happen later. We also have to worry about the Russian presence in Syria. So the Russian Air Force has now a base there. We have to worry about deconfliction because the primary objective of the U.S. is to defeat Daesh or ISIS there. The primary objective of the Russian military presence is not necessarily to defeat Daesh, but rather to support their ally, Bashar al-Assad. So the question is going to become, how can you successfully deconflict U.S. interests and Russian interests while you have jet fighters flying around in the same limited area?
And it's not evident how that will happen by the tone of your voice, Evan.
Precisely.
Jim, any idea there for you?
Well, I think, you know, this is one area where, you know, that President Trump, you know, campaigned on saying that ISIS and doing something about ISIS was his number one foreign policy initiative. If you go back and look at his first campaign speech. And even the successor has been kind of taken off the radar screen because of all of these other kind of tweets and domestic issues. But this is something that the Trump administration could point to in terms of some foreign policy success, it seems, in a relatively short period of time. But again, we'll have to see how that plays out in terms of Evan talks about here in terms of dealing with the Russians in Syria as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Northern Africa. Let's talk about the the horrendous attack in the Somali capital of Mogadishu. Of course, Mogadishu, no stranger to bombings over recent years, but not on the scale we saw last weekend, a bombing that killed more than 300, 500 casualties. This is Somalia's worst terror attack, blamed on al-Shabaab, a local violent Islamist group. Evan, how does this tie into the other conflicts we've been talking about in the Middle East?
Right, and as Jim alluded to, this is al-Shabaab is Arabic for, you know, sort of the guys, the young guys. And they've pledged allegiance to ISIS. And anytime you have a failed state like Somalia, what you end up with is a breeding ground for terrorism. And until you have civil society and a stable central government, you're going to have these sorts of terrorist groups running. You know, you have Boko Haram in Niger, for instance, as well. And so this destabilization in North Africa and the Middle East, including Yemen, is ripe for terrorist cells and networks to metastasize.
Mm-hmm. Niger, we had the killing of four American soldiers there a couple weeks ago, drawn attention to the role of U.S. troops there, Jim. So we had these, I mean, it's all tied up in this domestic politics with the president, the debate over Donald Trump's phone calls to soldiers grieving families killed in action there. But to a lot of us, it comes as, Niger, where is that? Why are we there with our military?
Yeah, I think the surprising thing is that the revelation that there may be up to 800 American soldiers there. You know, we're there to support the Niger government and you know, to train the military and so on. And I don't know if Evan can talk about it, but if he was involved in intelligence activities related to you know, some of these particularly Libya, because also there's a big training ground apparently for Al Qaeda or ISIS followers there. And so this whole area of northern Africa, maybe even down in the sub-Saharan Africa, is this kind of failed state environment, or at least this seemingly ungoverned area that makes it really possible to have the terrorist groups regroup.
What do you have to add as a former intelligence analyst, Evan?
Yeah, so the soldiers killed recently, these are Green Berets, Special Forces. They're bread and butter. Their mission set is not necessarily any sort of offensive engagement, or, you know, you don't raids or ambushes, but rather it is precisely to train local U.S. allies to fight and defend themselves and eliminate these terrorist training camps. Having said that, of course, even though you may not want to be directly engaged in fighting, and this goes to show you that there are no front lines in this war on terrorism, ambushes can happen anywhere, and the number of Special Forces or Green Berets in this region is increasing every day.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, I wanted to mention a comment Senator McCain made when he received the National Constitution Center's Liberty Medal presented to him by former Vice President Joe Biden. Interesting remarks. Perhaps you can respond to them. He argues that the U.S. has been blessed and has been a blessing to the world through stabilizing international conflicts. But he also had a warning that some people took as a veiled criticism of President Trump. Let's listen.
Fear the world we have organized and led the three quarters of a century to abandon the ideals we have advanced around the globe, to refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems. Is as unpatriotic as an attachment to any other tired dogma of the past that Americans consigned to the ash heap of history.
Okay, excerpt from John McCain receiving the National Constitution Center's Liberty Medal. I don't know if you heard more of the speech than we heard just there, Jim McCormick. Remarks, I guess we can say clearly, directed at our president.
Oh, I think so. I mean, the idea of rejecting the kind of global role, whether it's in the trade area or in the security area, is clearly something that so far has been the sort of the hallmark of the administration, the Trump administration, in terms of assuming this kind of leadership role or moving away from this leadership role, exactly what Senator McCain is talking about and alluding to. So I think there was no mistake in the target of his comments here.
More political news from, I guess, that ties our domestic scene with our foreign policy. Donald Trump refusing to certify to Congress that Iran is complying with the terms of the nuclear deal. The supreme leader of Iran has defended this 2015 nuclear deal made with other countries, but also under the previous administration of President Obama. He used some strong language to accuse President Trump of ranting and lying. He has threatened to terminate the agreement altogether. Donald Trump calling for a deal to be amended to prevent Iran in some ways. The EU here, Jim, saying it's determined to preserve the deal. So where does that leave the Iran agreement? I guess this is in the lap of Congress.
Yes, under the Nuclear Review Act, I mean, they do have 60 days to decide whether to reimpose sanctions or not. I would be very surprised if the Congress would enact any legislation here. And the agreement will then really remain into effect unless, President Trump took unilateral action to actually kill it. He could do that because it's basically an executive agreement that the United States entered into. But as the EU leader pointed out, it's really an appendage to a UN resolution, so it would remain in effect even if the United States would abandon the Iran deal. And I think there's little prospect that the European allies would reimpose any kind of sanctions on Iran. I mean, they've already moved in terms of Iran, in terms of economic investments, right, and so on. So I think the deal will stay in place, whether the United States is a party to it or not.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro, what do you make of these latest developments, the president refusing to certify to Congress Iran is complying with the deals of the terms of this deal?
Yeah, President Trump did in fact recertify in April and then again in July, but all of a sudden in October, he appears to be unsatisfied. Secretary of Defense Mattis has said, Iran is compliant. Blowing this deal up would be not in the interests of U.S. national security. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is the watchdog on these inspections. The head of the IAEA has said that Iran is under the most robust nuclear inspection regime in history and is compliant as far as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action goes. And you have this so-called P5 plus one, which is your permanent Security Council members, U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, along with Germany, along with the EU, have all signed this. And if the U.S. somehow reneged on this deal, as Jim says, the deal itself doesn't somehow go away. It just makes the U.S. Look like it's doing its own thing. And perhaps just as importantly, it really emboldens the most anti-U.S. politicians in Iran. You have to remember that Iranian President Rouhani is, by Iranian standards, a moderate guy. And he is trying to fight off sort of the radical elements to his right, and it is increasingly hard for him to do that when he sees the U.S. using this sort of rhetoric.
The Supreme Leader is not of that moderate category. His quote here in reaction to our president, "I don't want to waste time on answering the rants and whoppers," however it's translated, I have to believe a translation, "rants and whoppers of the brute U.S. president."
Right.
So,
you get into a Twitter war with these guys, and I'm not sure there's going to be a winner.
Okay.
Yeah, I think part of the objection of the Trump administration is that, there is this 24-day period of if there's a possible violation that before the inspection can take place. That's one of the issues. And, of course, the wider issue is that Iran has, in terms of international affairs, it has not seemingly not moderated as the Obama administration had hoped, it moderated some of its international activities as it was sort of brought back into the global community. Now, the agreement doesn't directly touch on that, and I suppose that is what the Trump administration and any renegotiation would like to include.
Jim McCormick, thank you so much for joining us from Canada, where you're on a Fulbright Fellowship this semester. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, professor of political science.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you, Jim. You take care of yourself. Evan Renfro in Cedar Falls, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Evan, what a joy to have you on board in our illustrious clan of political analysts we invite on Wednesdays. We look forward to talking with you again.
Hey, thank you very much, Ben. Enjoyed it.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Robbie Broad. Tony Daynor helped out today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.